Emily Dickinson, Inner Than the Bone. I first encountered the poems of Emily Dickinson when I was 16 in 1963. That, of course, is also Larkin's watershed year when sexual intercourse began between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. I remember both of them, along with the educational newspaper reports on the Profumo scandal. I still have my treasured copy of the sky blue Heinemann edition of selected poems by Emily Dickinson, and I remember reading in Blackwell's bookshop some of her startling lines for the very first time. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. Exaltation is the going of an inland soul to sea. For each ecstatic instant, we must an anguish pay in keen and quivering ratio to the ecstasy. I'd never read anything like her work, and the book was soon mine. That particular selection, edited and repunctuated by James Reeves, was then said to be the only one available in this country, where she seemed relatively little known or appreciated at that time, and reading her poems provided me with many fresh astonishments and recognitions. Wildflowers kindle in the woods. The brooks slam all the day. No blackbird baits his banjo for passing Calvary. In due course, I read more of her work and more about her. I bought the complete poems of Emily Dickinson, edited by Thomas H. Johnson, and gathered that she had highly individual ways of presenting and punctuating her poems, which went almost entirely unpublished in her own lifetime. So I started to reread them with her dashes in mind. Her poems and letters are full of searing aphorisms and hard-won wisdom. It might be lonelier without the loneliness. They encapsulate a cosmos of feeling in terse little epigrams of pain and pleasure, which delight and console by their very existence. If nature will not tell the tale Jehovah told to her, can human nature not survive without a listener? The individual vision is given subjective force in the space of a line or two. I like the look of agony, because I know it's true. Men do not sham convulsion nor simulate a throw. Her imagery has the repeated power to astonish. The prism never held the hues, it only heard them play. And like her poems, her letters could feed a dictionary of quotations for a day or more. The incredible never surprises us because it is the incredible. There is always one thing to be grateful for, that one is oneself and not somebody else. It comforts an instinct if another have felt it too. The sailor cannot see the north, but knows the needle can. She attacks platitudes and truisms with robust energy in quatrains derived from, but utterly unlike, hymns. They say that time assuages. Time never did assuage. And she coins fresh maxims out of the common language. Mirth is the male of anguish. The soul has bandaged moments. The brain is wider than the sky. Various biographies of her have been written, but in some ways her outer life does not matter, because the poems represent the inner life and the reason why the biography would be so compelling if we knew the full facts. Each Emily Dickinson poem seems like a transcript of the speaker's psyche, a cryptographic image of her inner nature and a vocal fragment of her being. Yet, apart from the poems and letters, we have relatively few mementos and tokens of her physical existence. It is almost as if, for Emily Dickinson, personal self-effacement was the counterpart to artistic exploration and self-fulfillment. And finally, as she said herself, "If I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire ever can warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only way I know it. Is there any other way?" That, or its understated British male equivalent, is roughly what happened to me when I first chanced upon her work as a schoolboy in Oxford over 50 years ago now, and for me, the power of her best poems has only increased with the passage of time.